This is Gilda Franz, 16 December 1985. Fate, Suffering, and Individuation.
There is distortion on this tape for the first 3 minutes or so. Then it's okay.
Thank you. Gilda Franz asked me to keep this short, so I just have a few notes here I'd like to quote from about her life's work. It's exciting, as you can imagine, to have an opportunity to interact with someone who lives this work and who has experienced her life fully and richly and who takes seriously the importance of this work in her own life and in her work with her clients. We're talking about how much that adds to our lives to have these positive role models of people who have studied and thought and felt and lived their own experience and then translated that into being able to apply that to other people, both in terms of their professional work and in terms of the life that they live every day. And I really would say unequivocally that it, I believe, will enrich all of us to have a chance to interact with someone like Gilda Franz. She's president of the CGU Institute in Los Angeles, which is where she received her training and became an analyst, and has really just an incredible wealth of experience, knowledge of the union community internationally. It's been very generous this evening in giving us names and suggestions of other people who might be good speakers for us, which we always appreciate. There's something about that sense then of this extended community in which we all are living and interacting, and we've come to feel that more and more, I know, within this group, and she really embodies that. We're looking forward to what she says to us about fate and suffering and individuation, and know that she was well received in Portland and highly regarded there. Would you please join me in welcoming Gilda Franz? You know how to hang it?
I don't know. No, I don't. Okay. I'm just going to clank at my nipples.
Get mine.
I'm
not a sensation type.
How does it look? No. I should have planned the outfit around the microphone. Forget about. How about all the introverts coming down to the front so that we can have a little bit more of an intimate feeling in this very intimate hall? Thank you very much, Marlon. I want to thank David Adams and Harold and Carl Schuba and Tom and all the people that have made my time here already very delightful. It's very wonderful to be in Seattle in the Northwest. And it looks like it's going to be an interesting evening judging by all of you, because I expect that we're going to have some kind of interaction and not just me sitting up here. Nobody moved. Very good. All right, so then if you're not going to move over physically, then you have to move over psychologically and get close. Last year, a very interesting thing happened in a daily way. In my daily newspaper, starting somewhere in February, there were a number of articles about events, world events, catastrophes, in which fate was mentioned. And it caught my attention. I thought, of all the places to see fate mentioned, that the newspaper would not be a place that I would have particularly expected to see it. So what that said to me was that I must have been in a place of beginning to think about fate. One of the first articles that I read had to do with John Hinckley. And it was an article where his parents were interviewed, and they talked about the fatefulness of what happened. Now, when he shot the president, that fateful act, done out of his own madness, his own sickness, affected his mother, his father, the president's wife, the man that he shot, the policeman, his sisters and brothers, his psychiatrist, I'm sure. Must have had a very profound effect upon his psychiatrist. It changed his father's and mother's life overnight. His father quit his job as president of some concern, and they subsequently formed a foundation for the parents and families of such young men. Their attitude was that, the father's attitude was, as many of you must know, that the son should have pulled himself up by his bootstraps, and the day that he shot the president was the day that he was given as the day that he should do something about himself. I think the father said something like, if you don't do it by whatever the day was, March, whatever. So if you think about that event, that one event, and you think about how that moment affected so many individuals in a dynamic way, not in just because you read about it, but in a way that utterly changed the direction of the father and mother, and et cetera, et cetera. Then you begin to see something about, as most of you know, I mean, I don't think I'm telling you anything new, something about the way fate works. Because fate is not just something that happens to you, but it sometimes is something that happens to you that also affects my life. The next event that I saw in the newspaper, which came within a couple of weeks, was a young black woman who had left her child, a five-year-old child, and the boy was home, and the teacher reported the fact that the boy was home, not in school. Policeman went and was scared because he felt he was set up in this kind of half light and so forth, and the child had a toy gun, and he killed the child. The mother was quoted in the paper as saying that her son had been born, she was evidently interested in numerology, and she said, my little boy was born under the sign of 7 and died under the number 3, or maybe it was reversed. And she took it as a fateful event. How else could you take that? How else could you live with it? Except to say that maybe the fates were involved in some way. Then there was an article about Admiral Zumwalt. Now, he was involved in, what was that called in Vietnam when they sprayed everything? Defoliation. Agent Orange, whatever that was. His son got sprayed by that. His son got sprayed by that. Very fateful thing to be involved in something and then have, it's as if the wind blew back on him. So those were the kind of events that occurred all within a very short time that caught my attention and my compassion, especially when I began to think about the man that killed the little boy and how dramatically that affected his life. Now, I'm talking about very dramatic events, very powerful events. How many of you here have had what you would call a fateful event in your life, whether you believe in the fates or not? Did it have that effect upon you of changing your life at that moment? Did you feel like you, yes, like you couldn't see life the same way again? Sure. Now, what I'm going to do tonight is I'm not going to give you count after account of tragedies in the newspaper. We don't have to look in the newspaper. You just look at your own life. If you have lived at all, then you have experienced some kind of loss. And loss is always experienced as some kind of tragedy. although the Greeks define loss as something that's a waste. They define tragedy, I'm sorry, not loss. They define tragedy as something that's wasted. But most of us experience loss as some sort of a powerful waste. So what I'm going to do tonight is we're going to hear some of Jung's words. I'm a Jungian analyst. I think I'll be making my way through Jung's books for the rest of my life. So this is my chance to say some of the things that he has said and then intersperse them. And then I'll tell you a little bit about the fates. I'm not a thinking type. Just bear with me. Well, I can't find that page. But anyway, the fates had dominion even over Zeus. The three fates, in their negative form, in their really relentless form, were called the Erinyes. In their kindly form, they were known as the Eumenides. The three graces are related to the fates. Now, the fates, these three sisters, had the effect of cutting the thread of life and weaving, and of being those elements in life that separate us from life and bring us into life. When I saw that in the newspaper that they were talking about the fates, I thought, these sisters are still active in our culture. In our Western rational culture, these newspaper articles all talked about fate. So I began to think a little bit about the fates, and the next thing that I did was I went into Jung's work to see what Jung had to say about fate. And what he had to say about fate, to me, talked about individuation. And it made me think that individuation itself is a fate. That those divine beings, the fates, very often set us in a direction from which either we have to accept that and we have to go with it, or we have hell to pay. And it's not always nice, you know? The idea, do you all of you agree with that? The idea that individuation may be meaningful, but it's a hard path, difficult path, worthwhile. Now, Jung says that insofar as a man is untrue to his own law and does not rise to his personality, he has failed the meaning of his life. Jung always says his, by the way, but he means humankind. Insofar as a man is untrue to his own law and does not rise to his personality, he has failed the meaning of his life. There's a book called Development of Personality, and it's volume 17, and the chapter called Development of Personality is one of the most brilliant explications of what he means by personality. He doesn't mean personality. He means the greater personality that lies within us, most of which is untapped in us. So what he means when he says that a man is untrue to his own law has to do with one's individuation. To be true to the law of one's own being. I'd be very happy, by the way, for any of you who want to know where the quotes come from to tell you, who would like to read more. Jung says, by the way, Jung says that the greatest courage that we have is to become the personality that we are capable of becoming. Said that that is one of the most courageous acts, because that act of being who you really are, if you're really honest with yourself, can be very tough in terms of the direction your life has to go in, what you do with your life. The sacrifices that are made, that are asked of you. This is one thing that he says. He says, all passion is a challenge to fate. And what it does cannot be undone. Fear of fate is very understandable, for it is incalculable, immeasurable, and full of unknown dangers. The perpetual hesitation of the neurotic, that's us, of the neurotic, not them, to launch into fate is readily explained by his desire to stand aside so as not to get involved in the dangerous struggle for existence. But anyone who refuses to experience life must stifle his desire to life. In other words, he must commit partial suicide. Do you know what partial suicide is? What do you think? Anybody have an idea? I'll repeat your thoughts. The death, who said that? Where did you? The death of the ego? From?
In the Hindu sense.
In the Hindu sense. So the death of the ego in the Hindu sense would mean a separating oneself from the material world or from what the ego wants and living the life of the self. More. Is that what you mean? The real self. I don't know if that's what he means on that score. Yes? I say that a little louder. If only the persona, the mask, so that if only one lives their life through the persona, then that would be partial suicide. Sure. What else would be partial suicide? That's a very heavy term, the idea. Okay. How would you, by cutting off part of your involvement, how would you cut off part of your involvement?
Like, how would they look at something and not look at it?
Look at it and not look at it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the, very good. All of those are all part of it. One of the ways that people commit partial suicide is by seeing what they need to do with their lives and being so afraid that they absolutely don't do anything. That is on the worst level. Now, one of the things that Jung says that I think is absolutely, if you take it in, is absolutely brilliant, just one, is he says that the only way that we humans change is if we are subjected to an inner or outer fatality. Now, where does the word fatality come from? What's fatal, if not fated? If we're subjected to what an inner fatality would be, what you just said, which would be the Hindu meaning of the death of the ego. An outer fatality might be the loss of a loved one, a father, a brother, a teacher, a country. That's a horrendous fatality to experience. Those inner or outer fatalities are the edge of what changes us. That's what it takes. It takes that, because why change? Why change? Why grow? Why be uncomfortable? Why not just curl up and be happy? You know what happy means, by the way? Happy comes from the root of the word fortune. Happy means luck. We all want luck. Who doesn't want to be happy? But as a goal, it's rough, because it only happens once in a while. Oh, yes.
Can you say some more about inner fatality?
Sure. The death of a dream is an inner fatality. I worked with a woman who studied to be a ballet dancer from the time that she was this big. It was, I don't know whether it was her idea, probably her mother's or an aunt's or someone. And she studied ballet every single day of her life and got to be a grown-up person. And she always assumed that she would go off, you know, and be a ballet dancer. Well, she was a very passive, shy, introverted, not aggressive, not pushy, not grown-up person. And one day she was thinking about whether she would go off to New York and dance with whoever the great was of her era. And her teacher said, you know, you're not going to be able to do that. And she said, why? And the teacher said, well, you can dance, but you don't have the this and the that, you know, all the other things that it takes. Well, who knows if her teacher was right? Are any of you ballet teachers? One? No? Maybe the teacher knew something. Maybe the teacher could see that this was a very shy and developed person. The inner fatality was the killing of that possibility. It was just like, and she no longer danced. It was the end. The fact is that she had to be very young to take the teacher so literally. Who knows what the teacher meant? You know, maybe she was trying to goad her. But whatever it was, it killed that dream. And the young woman had always lived under what I would call in Jungian terms a very powerful mother archetype. Her personal mother was a powerful decider. You're going to do this, and she knew how to tell everybody how to live their lives. So she grew up under the aegis of that powerful mother archetype and kind of just gave up everything. And she did eventually get a kind of a career, something she did for a living. But she came into analysis in absolute mourning, as if someone had died in her life, many years later. She'd gotten involved in drugs, something to dull the pain, something to replace it. That would you explain that as an inner fatality? Would that satisfy your... must have had an idea, though.
No, I was curious. It seems that something like that is the question of, at what point do you realize that you're dead?
Okay.
When you're delivered the message or when you're
dreaming. Okay, that's a very good point. At what point do you decide that the dream is dead? Well, I don't know whether you do decide. But that was a fateful moment in her life when that teacher said that. And she took it literally. It might have taken somebody else right to New York and said, the hell with you, I'm going anyway. But this young person couldn't deal with that. The teacher must have carried something powerful. So that inner fatality sent her off in another direction. What do you think she would have to do in her life? Now, when she's 35 and comes into analysis, is she going to become a ballet dancer? Hardly. So then she has to somewhere find a way to live what has been shut away in her, what has been partially killed, because what happens when you shut one thing away, a lot of other things get shut away. You know that old expression that if you keep a secret in, you keep a lot of other things in too? You know, if you can't say something, do you ever have that, someone's having a surprise party and you're not supposed to tell, so you don't talk to them? Why? Because you're... So, along with keeping her out of dance, she eventually stopped answering her phone. She eventually got agoraphobia. She eventually didn't go in the world. A lot of symptoms came about, a lot of phobias. And you know what the main phobia was? It's so interesting. She had a fear of fire. And the way the fear of fire manifested itself is that she would leave the house in the morning, go back. The minute she'd walk out the door, she'd go back and check to be sure the stove wasn't on. Then she'd leave again. Then she'd go back and check to see that the stove wasn't on. Now, fire is one of the symbols for fate. And you could say that the fear of the fire might have been the fear of what was shut away. What would be shut away would be her passion. You can imagine what it did to her life that this inner fatality occurred. Now, there are positive aspects to inner fatalities, and that would be the final letting go of something that needs to die. You know, if you go through life with the same ego attitude that you had when you were four, which maybe this young woman did, mommy, tell me what to do, can I, you know, but if you go through life with that same ego attitude, you're in trouble. So you have to say that that ego has to go through many deaths and rebirths in the Western sense. The way I feel about the giving up of the ego in the Eastern sense is that before you give something up, you have to have it. And a lot of people don't have what we might call a well-developed ego, a solid ego. It's hard to give away $1 million if you've only got a dollar. So I have some other thoughts about that. So what Jung says here is that it's that all passion is a challenge to fate, that it's understandable to be afraid of one's fate, that because it's full of the unknown, and that this hesitation on the part of the neurotic to launch into life is explained by his desire to stand aside so he doesn't get involved in the dangerous struggle for existence. Why does Jung call the struggle for existence dangerous? I'm not going to give you all the answers. Risky. What's risky? Your contemporary present attitude is might get banged up. Now, I recently had a very fateful thing happen to me. I expect you to share your lives with me. I'll share my life with you. I was in my office. I have a statue I brought back from Egypt. You can analyze the hell out of this if you want to. I have. And then come to me with anything that you think that I may have missed. I dropped a bronze statue of Isis on my foot. Not intentionally. It was an accident. I was not prepared to launch. Anyway, she fell on one of her horns, tiny little statue. And one of her, you know, she has this disc and then these beautiful horns. I'll show you, I brought a picture. And one of the horns, I mean, she fell point down on my foot and broke it. Not the statue. When I got over the immediate pain after the cast was drying, I thought, this lady really wants my attention in the worst way. I took it as a direct message, as if the goddess were alive, as if she walked into my... And you are, I know you are. She walked into my office and she said, listen to me. Pay attention. Why are you forgetting about this and this and this and this and this? Well, when you break a bone and you're in a cast, I'm sure others have had the experience, you don't go anywhere. Well, if you don't go out, where do you go? You go in. So I went in, found a very interesting bunch of associations to Isis and Hathor. And no, this is Horus, not Hathor. Her son and Osiris and how she brought life out of wood and all kinds of incredible things, you know. What was she trying to say to me? It's going to take a while to figure it all out. But the point is it was a fateful occurrence in time, and pay attention to that. By the way, the fates were never hated in ancient Greece. No matter, the fates were considered to rectify certain things that human laws could not cover. You think about that when you know someone and you say, well, they'll get what they deserve. You know, maybe they got out of law or they got out of the court, didn't do that, but they'll get what they deserve. Well, who knows? But that's what the fates were considered to be specialists at, rectifying especially problems within families. So they were not hated, even though they brought heavy, heavy things to people. And as I said, even Zeus was subjected to fate, destiny, and necessity. Jung says something about the fates. He says, all of these symbols can have a positive, favorable meaning or a negative, evil meaning. An ambivalent aspect is seen in the goddesses of fate, the Moira. Evil symbols of the fates would be the witch, the dragon, any devouring and twining animal, the grave, the sarcophagus, deep water. These are, by the way, very interesting to note if you have such dreams of such symbols, with such symbols. About individuation, Jung says that it is the process of differentiation having for its goal the development of the individual personality. I think that's really clear. Have any of you ever met an individuated person that's alive? Because there are none. There are people who are in the process of individuation. You are probably all, undoubtedly, in the process of individuation and have been since birth, maybe before. But it's not something that you're done with. A woman where I gave a talk on this subject said, I'm 42. I figured I was done with this by now. Well, individuation is a process of differentiating that takes you through your entire life. And if you look at your childhood dreams, any of you who remember, I know all of you probably remember one childhood dream. Maybe not, but usually there's a nightmare from childhood. Take a look at it. Don't just file it away. Take a look at it. See if it has hints of where you are now. See whether there's a hint in that dream of the direction your life took. Because children have dreams having to do with individuation. A woman told me about a dream having to do with her childhood, in which she dreamt that there was a tremendous splitting open of the earth, and she was on one side of this chasm slipping in, and her mother or father, parents, were on the other side. Well, that's a real Persephone dream, in which Persephone is in a field and smelling flowers. She leans over it was a narcissus, wasn't it? She leans over and smells the narcissus, and just at that moment, Hades splits open the earth, and she falls into the underworld. Well, the person who had this dream, it was a heralding of a relationship to the unconscious, where the unconscious just opened up before her, separating her from her parents, her natural parents. So you could say that person already, there was an indication of a hard and difficult fate in that child already. Do you see that? You can say no. Well, I do. It was my dream. Jung says, he's quoting here, give up what thou hast, then thou shalt receive. And he says they are called upon to abandon all their cherished illusions in order that something deeper, fairer, and more embracing may arise within them. Only through the mystery of self-sacrifice can a man find himself anew. When you have experienced an inner or outer fatality, you become aware of something other than your current conventional ego attitude about life. Isn't that true? That you go through something and you say, God, I don't feel the same anymore. Now, if you give up something consciously, it's not as raping as if it's taken away from you without knowing that you are making a conscious sacrifice. I think Jung is so poetic. Do any of you read Jung, or do you read Jungians? Well, do you read Jung? Good. Some people think that he's hard. You know, Freud is very linear and very clear. Jung's writing is very intuitive. And so some people of different typology find this kind of, you know, this circulating around and around and around hard to stay with. But it's worth it. Now, for people, how many of you are psychotherapists? This is an interesting thing that he says about fate. He says, it's in psychology, he wrote this, I think, in 1935. He says, in psychology, it's very important that the doctor should not strive to heal at all costs. One has to be exceedingly careful not to impose one's will and conviction on the patient. You cannot wrest people away from their fate. That gives fate a certain dignity. That there is something within that individual that is part of them that you're not, if you're a psychotherapist, you're not going to just say, well, I can change that person. He says, sometimes it's really a question whether you're called to rescue a man from a fate he must undergo for the sake of his further development. So sometimes in psychotherapy, you can see someone going headlong into what to us would look like a disaster, but which may be the very disaster that that individual needs in order to effect this change. That is from the Tavistock lectures, and it's in a. I took it from a book called Psychological Reflections by Yolanda Jacoby, and it's a wonderful book of sayings of Jung's, just kind of outtakes. So that's where that's from. He says that we can only gain merit in psychologic development. It's page 147. We can only gain merit in psychologic development by accepting ourselves as we are and by being serious enough to live the lives we are trusted with. What is that? That's your life. He says that our sins and our errors and our mistakes are necessary to us, otherwise we're deprived of the most precious incentives to development. Yes?
How can you talk a little bit about synchronicity in regards to
fate? Can I talk about synchronicity in regards to fate? That's what I was sure. What do you want to know? I don't distinguish between them. I don't distinguish between fate and synchronicity because there's something fateful about arriving at a particular moment in time and another, let's say, individual arriving at that exact moment in time, and that these two events being brought together, you can say it was fate, you can say it's synchronicity. I think that I'm sure that someone with a more scholarly bent would be able to give you a large. And if there's anyone in the audience that thinks that they would like to know, Harold? No? To be able to really talk about the acausal aspects of synchronicity, whereas perhaps you might see fate as something other, I think they're very, very close. I think they're very close. I would take Isis falling on my foot at that moment in my life. See, I'm not going to tell you my life story, tempting as it is. What time is it? But at that moment in my life, to have Isis hit my foot, to me, was a synchronistic event. Now, synchronicity, there. Have any of you read Jean Boland's The Tao of Psychology? So she talks about little synchronicities. I'm talking about big synchronicities. I'm talking about big one, the kind that you get a shiver. I mean, when this thing fell on my foot, I thought I'd been shot. I didn't know what hit me. I looked, I thought, my God, it was like a bullet. It was not a little synchronicity in terms of what it's done inside. So I think it's a great question because I think it's very pertinent to the idea. Now, one of the things that I was, that the title of the talk talked about had to do with suffering. And one of the most common experiences that we all have is suffering, human suffering. The different places that I've been in the world, I've asked certain what might be called sages or holy men, what is the meaning of suffering? And they all give different answers, but they all are kind of the same. It isn't that one has to stay stuck in suffering, but you better take a long look at what is the cause of your suffering. What is the meaning? What is the depth? What does it burn from you? My experience with suffering is that it burns away superfluities, that it burns us down to our essential self. Suffering and the development of the individuation process are very connected, because it seems that we can go along very well doing whatever we do until something occurs, this inner or outer fatality, which causes us to suffer. And if you look at the suffering, if you look at what's making you cry, if you look at what's hurting you, and you don't say, oh, that's my pattern, or oh, there I go again, But if you really say, what am I doing? What is this doing to me? You can begin to affect some change. So that's what Jung means when he says, our mistakes are necessary to us, otherwise we're deprived of the precious incentives to development. Anyone here want to be a perfect person? Sure. Well, you know, the best, most wonderful thing that Jung says about that is that the goal of life is wholeness, not perfection. Even Native Americans leave a little opening in their sand paintings so that they won't be perfect. Jung says, I trust there is a will to live in everybody which will help them to choose the thing which is right for them. On some level, you're the only ones who know what is right for you. And when you go against that, then you're going to get advice from everybody. And Jung says that when I'm treating a man, I must be exceedingly careful not to knock him down with my views or my personality, because he has to fight his lonely fight. And he must be able to trust in his incomplete armor and his own imperfect aim, but he has to plow his own field. He says, my plow might be better, but what good is it to him? So I think that's really a really pungent statement about how each of us has to figure out how to do this ourselves and not copy anyone. Volume 18, he writes, however slight the effect of a particular dream may be, the unconscious compensation is of great importance for a man's conscious life and for what one calls his fate. The archetypes naturally play a considerable role, and it is no accident that these determining factors have always been personified in the forms of gods and demons. However slight the effect of a particular dream, the unconscious compensation is of great importance for man's conscious life and for what he calls fate. How many of you take your dreams seriously? Fantastic. And you keep journals and write them down? Mm-hmm. Great. Well, so then this would have a lot of meaning, because what he talks about, the slight effect of a particular dream, the unconscious compensation would have to do with the awareness of that archetypal level of existence. Now, you know, one of the inner fatalities has to do with the archetype that one gets identified with. One of the easiest things for a woman is to get identified with the mother archetype and live her life through the mother archetype. It's a natural thing. Have you ever known a young man, maybe 16 or 17, who lives his life through the father archetype? Have you ever seen a young man like that, who takes care of things and tells people what to do and takes care of his parents and so forth? So you could say that the archetypes, that if one lives one's life, let's say, through the mother archetype, that might be living an incomplete life in terms of the rest of the menu of all the other possibilities that one has. So that one of the fatalities might be one's identification with a particular archetype. Has anyone ever had that experience where they became conscious of living their life through a particular kind of archetype? Jean Boland would say, like, which goddess are you living your life through? But what archetype do you think Nixon is caught in? What archetype do you think Reagan is caught in? Think about it. Think about the effect that their identification with a particular archetype has on our lives and our fate. Yes? Speak up, though.
Ariel.
Well, I think the archetypes play a tremendous part in our lives, sure. No, I don't think as a persona. I think that one can get very caught and identified with the hero, with... I've known, you know, women that look as though they were carved out of a queen. That they are so identified with a kind of regal self idea. Young men who are identified with what is called the puer, that's an archetype. The animus is an archetype. The anima is an archetype. So that Jung's idea of the archetypes in the collective unconscious are, they weave their way through all of our lives. But we don't all have to get identified with them. We don't have to have them live our lives for us. You know, when you know someone is identified completely with an archetype, you know what they're going to say next. Have you ever known that? In literature, I think it's called a certain kind of two-dimensional quality to the character in writing. But have you ever known someone where you knew exactly what they were going to say? Because out of that archetypal place, they're not speaking out of their humanness and their... Now, one of the best things I can tell you about fate, since you're all adults, is that Jung says that the fate of the child is directly connected to the fate of the parents, but that the fate of the adult is not. So somewhere along the line, you can say, yes, I was born to this mother and father, and yes, I suffered because they were so blind and they didn't know who I was, and yes, we lived in poverty and in the Midwest or in Brooklyn or wherever, and the reason I didn't study piano was because I came from a non-musical family, or because I didn't become a mathematician because no one in my family ever went to college, and so forth. When you become an adult, then your fate is not tied to where you were born and who you were born to. Then you make your own fate. Then you have to stop and say, then my actions make my fate, not what my mother did or my father did. Sure, they're influences, but that feels very good to me somehow, that place of coming to a place of saying, I am responsible in some way. Now, do you know how you're responsible for your fate? It has to do with consciousness. Consciousness mitigates this kind of terrible fate that the ancients called heimermene. It's a wonderful word. Thinking of having a t-shirt made that way. Heimermene. I shouldn't make a joke about it because it's really... It's heimermene is the compulsion of the stars. And when one is under the compulsion of the stars... Oh, here it is. Oh, how wonderful. I didn't number these pages, by the way. This is very... Talk about just allowing it. You know, it's like if something is wonderful, do you have to know where to cut the cake? It's, you know, I think that, I don't mean I am, but it's like anywhere you slice this, isn't that right, Marla? Anywhere you slice this material, it's wonderful. So I figured, what does it matter if there's a thread? This is what Jung says about heimermene. He says that men of late antiquity in particular felt their psychic situation to be fatally dependent on the compulsion of the stars, heimermene, a feeling which may be compared with that inspired by the modern theory of heredity, or rather the pessimistic use of it. A similar demoralization sets in many neuroses when the patient takes the psychic factors producing the symptoms as though they were unalterable facts which it is useless to resist. It is not wonderful to be under the compulsion of the stars. That is a situation where one feels that they are gripped. There is nothing that can be done. There is no way out. There is no doorway they can go through. This is it. It's inexorable. And that is a state of unconsciousness when things are that inexorable. The thing that mitigates to me, by the way, you're getting my bias. You know, you have to deal with your own bias. This is my bias. This is my moment to be biased in front of you. But I think the thing that mitigates fate has to do with your consciousness, with the development of consciousness, so that you say, like the young ballet dancer didn't, well, how do I know what that woman is saying when she says that to me? And how does she know what's right for me? And how can she tell me what to do when I don't even know what I'm supposed to do? And so her consciousness about who she is and what she is and what she's capable of would have changed that particular fate. Might have. No, not would. Might have. Does that make sense? That once, so it isn't like fate isn't, I'm not talking about do you believe in fate. It's not like some religion. Do you believe in fate? But I'm talking about being conscious. Consciousness is hard. It's hard. It means that you have to separate yourself from the collective way of thinking. It means that you have to really think about the rightness of things for yourself. It may go against society, what you think. It may not be your family's idea about how they would like you to be, what they would like you to be. It's hard.
When you talk about consciousness, are you talking about a connection between consciousness and unconscious?
I'm talking about what we wrest from the unconscious and bring into consciousness. That shuttle back and forth, that's right. Mm-hmm. You hope there's a bridge between those two and not a chasm. Because if it's a chasm, that's a really long way to go down, and then you bring it back up, and maybe you'll drop it along the way.
I'm struggling as I'm listening to you. I have no background in Jung, but I have a background in family therapy, and they talk about the individuation process occurring in the context of your family of origin, and that you are in a certain sense fated to that invisible loyalty to your previous generation. And the process of individuation has to do with separating that off, which seems to be a shuttling from unconscious to the conscious back and forth in the present day, that is going back to stories of the past and dealing with the parents and their relationships to their own parents, etc., and bringing it more into consciousness, which I guess is what you're talking about.
Yes. What are you having difficulty with?
Well, it seems to me that you imply that when you make it conscious, and it's okay now, and I don't...
I said that? I don't... I hope not. Oh, I hope not. I certainly didn't mean to say, you know, wow, transformation, you know. No, I really didn't mean that. I'm sorry if you got that idea. I'm trying to say that this is one of the most difficult, painful things you can do is to go your way. And it certainly is not something that's a simple matter, that once you do it, then everything's fine. I don't think I said that. I don't know whether you all heard what this gentleman said. Are the acoustics pretty good? Okay, then I won't repeat it. In volume 11, he says, if you sum up what people tell you about their experience, you could formulate it in this way. They came to themselves, they could accept themselves, they were able to become reconciled to adverse circumstances and events. This is very much like what was formerly expressed by saying, he made his peace with God, he has sacrificed his own will, and he has submitted himself to the will of God. That would be another way, I think, of saying that in the process of individuation, one becomes aware of a higher self, of a greater self, of what Jung calls the greater personality, and that there is a sacrifice of one's ego attitude, of that current ego attitude, in the service of the self. It's what Edinger talked about, an ego and archetype, which I recommend very much to any of you who have not read it, Edward Edinger, Ego and Archetype. I wanted to ask all of you how you would like to handle whether we have a break or whether we just go on and have questions as we go. If you need a break, you do. Okay, then we can take like a 10-minute break. Is that enough time to climb down out of the seats and back up again? How about 10 minutes, and we'll come back and I'll finish this. Do you all talk about things with each other? A lot of people came up and said, I don't understand this or that, and I really appreciate that. You don't have to like this. You don't have to agree. In fact, if you don't agree, it will be like a little piece of sand inside of you, and then pearls will develop. You don't have to be a good audience. Anything pressing anyone before we launch back into these last few pages?
I have one question in relationship to your use of the word faith.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the ballet, particularly in ballet, and the teacher tell her, you know, you know, whatever. And, you know, you call that faith. And that's questioning. I use the word trust. How do you start to differentiate faith? In other words, somebody else might have listened to that ballet teacher and said, you know, she's full of trust. I'm not.
Sure.
I'm going to go on. This girl, you know, made a choice. Believe
it. Did she make a choice?
Well,
if she made a choice, then we have nothing to talk about.
Well, it may not have been a conscious choice.
Oh, well, that's what.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she made a choice. You see, if I thought she'd made a choice, I think it might have been different. I think what I was saying to someone during the break is that she was a very young, unconscious person. She was in the grip of what you would call the archetype of the child. She stayed in the archetype of the child most of her life. She was not aware of the inner child. She was identified with it. Her bumping up against this teacher saying, I don't think you have what it takes, was like the first, I guess you could say, disappointment of many that had happened in her life, but the first that she had really set her sights on. It's as if she were a little architect who had been building a little construction, and when she got it finished, it fell over. I'm not using the word fate as if this was her fate. I'm saying that this was a fateful moment in her life when her teacher said these words, and she didn't make a choice and say, well, should I do this or should I do that? But she just took it. Now, I say that was a fateful moment because it changed her entire life. Up to that moment, her life had been going in one direction. The minute that happened, it changed her entire life. Now, how would you see that differently than this man whose son shot Reagan, and he was going along in his life, and he had his own business, and he was a conservative businessman who didn't believe in mental illness, who believed in free will and do it and get yourself together, son, and go out and get a job that'll cure everything, and that his son fell apart, and at that moment his entire life changed.
If you don't believe he had a choice at that point consciously to come to some decision within himself, whether or not to stop his business or continue on it?
When would he do that? Wait, when would he? Yes, of course I believe that. If he had said, my son is mentally ill, and he needs to be in a home, and I need to be a father to him, or I can recognize what schizophrenia looks like, or paranoid delusions, or whatever. Yes, it would have changed a lot of things. Anyway, I don't want to keep this all back, but maybe we're just not understanding each other. You know, maybe we're just.
There seems to me to be a lot of hope that people get when they realize that there were many unconscious decisions or choices they made. Because they were equipped, perhaps, they call it fate, whatever you think. But by the time you reach adulthood, you can go back and sort all of those things out and say, hey.
You think I'm.
And I made a wrong choice.
You think I'm judging her somewhere? No? See, I think what Jung said that I think you need to hear is that he said that these so-called mistakes are very necessary in our lives. I'm not saying that she should have done this if she had done this, this, and this, and this. I'm not even saying that this young man should not have shot Raven. I don't know. Wait a minute. Is this connected? No, I didn't mean it that way. But I mean, there's just a lot of things that, there's a book called The Inner World of Choice. Have any of you heard of it? Written by a woman in her 90s. Not too many women in their 90s that sit down and take up a pen. Frances Wicks, and it's in paperback. And what? Oh, I recommend it very much, sure. Wicks, W-I-C-K-E-S, thank you. Jung says that the power of fate makes itself unpleasantly felt only when everything goes against our will. That is to say, when we are no longer in harmony with ourselves. The ancients accordingly brought into relation with the primal light or primal fire, the Stoic conception of the ultimate cause, or the all-pervading warmth which produced everything and is therefore fate. You see, he uses fate 100 different ways, and you're just going to have to bend, that's all. I certainly have. He says this warmth, this will be shown later, is a libido image. Later, he quotes Schiller as saying, "The stars of thine own fate lie in thy breast. A man's fortunes," says Emerson, "are the fruits of his character." That's in an essay Emerson wrote on fate. By the way, there's a very interesting book called The Golden Ass by Apuleius. It was written by a man, I think, in the, what century? I feel like second or something, but long time ago, quite a few hundred years ago. And Marie-Louise von France, no relative, sorry to say, wrote a book in which she analyzes complete life. In terms of the rest of the menu, of all the other possibilities that one has. So that one of the fatalities might be one's identification with a particular archetype. Has anyone ever had that experience where they became conscious of living their life through a particular kind of archetype? Jean Boland would say, like, which goddess are you living your life through? But what archetype do you think Nixon is caught in? What archetype do you think Reagan is caught in? Think about it. Think about the effect that their identification with a particular archetype has on our lives and our fate. Yes? Speak up, though. Well, I think the archetypes play a tremendous part in our lives, sure. No, I don't think as a persona. I think that one can get very caught and identified with the hero, with... I've known, you know, women that look as though they were carved out of a queen. That they are so identified with a kind of regal self idea. Young men who are identified with what is called the puer, that's an archetype. The animus is an archetype. The anima is an archetype. So that Jung's idea of the archetypes in the collective unconscious are, they weave their way through all of our lives. But we don't all have to get identified with them. We don't have to have them live our lives for us. You know, when you know someone is identified completely with an archetype, you know what they're going to say next. Have you ever known that? In literature, I think it's called a certain kind of two-dimensional quality to the character in writing. But have you ever known someone where you knew exactly what they were going to say? Because they're speaking out of that archetypal place. They're not speaking out of their humanness and their... Now, one of the best things I can tell you about fate, since you're all adults, is that Jung says that the fate of the child is directly connected to the fate of the parents, but that the fate of the adult is not. So somewhere along the line, you can say, yes, I was born to this mother and father, and yes, I suffered because they were so blind and they didn't know who I was, and yes, we lived in poverty in the Midwest or in Brooklyn or wherever, and the reason I didn't study piano was because I came from a non-musical family, or because I didn't become a mathematician because no one in my family ever went to college, and so forth. When you become an adult, then your fate is not tied to where you were born and who you were born to. Then you make your own fate. Then you have to stop and say, then my actions make my fate, not what my mother did or my father did. Sure, they're influences, but that feels very good to me somehow, that place of coming to a place of saying, I am responsible in some way. Now, do you know how you're responsible for your fate? It has to do with consciousness. Consciousness mitigates this kind of terrible fate that the ancients called heimermene. It's a wonderful word. Thinking of having a t-shirt made that way. Heimermene. I shouldn't make a joke about it because it's really... It's heimermene is the compulsion of the stars. And when one is under the compulsion of the stars... Oh, here it is. Oh, how wonderful. I didn't number these pages, by the way. This is very... Talk about just allowing it. You know, it's like if something is wonderful, do you have to know where to cut the cake? That's, you know, I think that... I don't mean I am, but it's like anywhere you slice this... Isn't that right, Marla? Anywhere you slice this material, it's wonderful. So I figured, what does it matter if there's a thread? This is what Jung says about heimermene. He says that men of late antiquity in particular felt their psychic situation to be fatally dependent on the compulsion of the stars, heimermene, a feeling which may be compared with that inspired by the modern theory of heredity, or rather the pessimistic use of it. A similar demoralization sets in many neuroses when the patient takes the psychic factors producing the symptoms as though they were unalterable facts which it is useless to resist. It is not wonderful to be under the compulsion of the stars. That is a situation where one feels that they are gripped. There is nothing that can be done. There is no way out. There is no doorway they can go through. This is it. It's inexorable. And that is a state of unconsciousness when things are that inexorable. The thing that mitigates, to me, by the way, you're getting my bias. You know, you have to deal with your own bias. This is my bias. This is my moment to be biased in front of you. But I think the thing that mitigates fate has to do with your consciousness, with the development of consciousness, so that you say, like the young ballet dancer didn't, well, how do I know what that woman is saying when she says that to me? And how does she know what's right for me? And how can she tell me what to do when I don't even know what I'm supposed to do? And so her consciousness about who she is and what she is and what she's capable of would have changed that particular fate. Might have. No, not would. Might have. Does that make sense? that one's, so it isn't like fate isn't, I'm not talking about do you believe in fate. It's not like some religion. Do you believe in fate? But I'm talking about being conscious. Consciousness is hard. It's hard. It means that you have to separate yourself from the collective way of thinking. It means that you have to really think about the rightness of things for yourself. It may go against society, what you think. It may not be your family's idea about how they would like you to be, what they would like you to be. It's hard.
When you talk about consciousness, are you talking about a connection between consciousness and the unconscious?
I'm talking about what we wrest from the unconscious and bring into consciousness. At that shuttle back and forth, that's right. Mm-hmm. You hope there's a bridge between those two and not a chasm. Because if it's a chasm, that's a really long way to go down, and then you bring it back up and maybe you'll drop it along the way.
I'm struggling as I'm listening to you. I have no background in Jung, but I have a background in family therapy, and we talk about the individuation process occurring in the context of your family of origin, and that you are in a certain sense fated to that invisible loyalty to your previous generation. And the process of individuation has to do with separating that off, which seems to be a shuttling from the unconscious to the conscious back and forth in the present day, that is going back to the stories of the past and their relationships to their events, etc., and bringing more into consciousness, which I guess is what you're talking about.
Yes. What are you having difficulty with?
Well, it seems to me that you imply that when you make it conscious, and everything's okay now, and I don't...
I said that?
Well,
I don't...
It seems to imply...
I hope not. I certainly didn't mean to say, you know, wow, transformation, you know. No, I really didn't mean that. I'm sorry if you got that idea. I'm trying to say that this is one of the most difficult, painful things you can do is to go your way, and it certainly is not something that's a simple matter, that once you do it, then everything's fine. I don't think I said that. I don't know whether you all heard what this gentleman said. Are the acoustics pretty good? Okay, then I won't repeat it. In volume 11, he says, if you sum up what people tell you about their experience, you could formulate it in this way. They came to themselves. They could accept themselves. They were able to become reconciled to adverse circumstances and events. This is very much like what was formerly expressed by saying, he made his peace with God, he has sacrificed his own will, and he has submitted himself to the will of God. That would be another way, I think, of saying that in the process of individuation, one becomes aware of a higher self, of a greater self, of what Jung calls the greater personality. And that there is a sacrifice of one's ego attitude, of that current ego attitude, in the service of the self. It's what Edinger talked about, an ego and archetype, which I recommend very much to any of you who have not read it. Edward Edinger, Ego and Archetype. I wanted to ask all of you how you would like to handle whether we have a break or whether we just go on and have questions as we go. If you need a break, you do? Okay, then we can take like a 10-minute break. Is that enough time to climb down out of the seats and back up again? How about 10 minutes and we'll come back and I'll finish this. Do you all talk about things with each other? A lot of people came up and said, I don't understand this or that, and I really appreciate that. You don't have to like this. You don't have to agree. In fact, if you don't agree, it will be like a little piece of sand inside of you, and then pearls will develop. You don't have to be a good audience. Anything pressing anyone before we launch back into these last few pages?
I have one question in relationship to your use of the word taste.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the ballet, personally in the ballet, as a teacher's helper, you know, you love that, whatever. And when you call that taste, that's questioning, I use the word trust. How do you start to differentiate from taste? In other words, somebody else might have mentioned to that gallon figure,
sure.
I'm going to go on.
Did she make a choice?
Oh,
if she made a choice, then we have nothing to talk about.
Well, it may not have been a conscious choice.
Oh, well, that's what. I don't think she made a choice. You see, if I thought she'd made a choice, I think it might have been different. I think what I was saying to someone during the break is that she was a very young, unconscious person. She was in the grip of what you would call the archetype of the child. She stayed in the archetype of the child most of her life. She was not aware of the inner child. She was identified with it. Her bumping up against this teacher saying, I don't think you have what it takes, was like the first, I guess you could say, disappointment of many that had happened in her life, but the first that she had really set her sights on. It's as if she were a little architect who had been building a little construction, and when she got it finished, it fell over. I'm not using the word fate as if this was her fate. I'm saying that this was a fateful moment in her life when her teacher said these words, and she didn't make a choice and say, well, should I do this or should I do that? But she just took it. Now, I say that was a fateful moment because it changed her entire life. Up to that moment, her life had been going in one direction. The minute that happened, it changed her entire life. Now, how would you see that differently than this man whose son shot Reagan, and he was going along in his life? And he had his own business, and he was a conservative businessman who didn't believe in mental illness, who believed in free will and do it and get yourself together, son, and go out and get a job that'll cure everything, and that his son fell apart, and at that moment his entire life changed.
If you don't believe he had a choice at that point consciously to come to some decision within himself,
when would he do that? Wait, when would he? Yes, of course I believe that. If he had said, my son is mentally ill and he needs to be in a home and I need to be a father to him, or I can recognize what schizophrenia looks like or paranoid delusions or whatever, yes, it would have changed a lot of things. Anyway, I don't want to keep this all back, but maybe we're just not understanding each other. You know, maybe we're just...
There seems to me to be a lot of hope that people get when they realize that there were many unconscious decisions or choices they made because they were in grips, perhaps. They call it fate, whatever you think. But by the time you reach adulthood, you can go back and sort all of those things out and say, hey...
You think I'm...
And they say, I made a wrong choice.
You think I'm judging her somewhere, no? See, I think what Jung said that I think you need to hear is that he said that these so-called mistakes are very necessary in our lives. I'm not saying that she should have done this if she had done this, this, and this, and this. I'm not even saying that this young man should not have shot Reagan. I don't know. Wait a minute. Is this connected? No, I didn't mean it that way. But I mean, There's just a lot of things that there's a book called The Inner World of Choice. Have any of you heard of it? Written by a woman in her 90s. Not too many women in their 90s that sit down and take up a pen. Francis Wicks, and it's in paperback. And what?
Is it a book that you
recommend? Oh, I recommend it very much, sure. Wicks, W-I-C-K-E-S, thank you. Jung says that the power of fate makes itself unpleasantly felt only when everything goes against our will. That is to say, when we are no longer in harmony with ourselves. The ancients accordingly brought into relation with the primal light or primal fire the Stoic conception of the ultimate cause or the all-pervading warmth which produced everything and is therefore fate. You see, he uses fate 100 different ways. And you're just going to have to bend, that's all. I certainly have. He says this warmth, as will be shown later, is a libido image. Later, he quotes Schiller as saying, "The stars of thine own fate lie in thy breast. A man's fortunes," says Emerson, "are the fruits of his character." That's in an essay Emerson wrote on fate. By the way, there's a very interesting book called The Golden Ass by Apuleius. It was written by a man, I think, in the, what century? I feel like second or something, but long time ago, quite a few hundred years ago. And Marie-Louise von Franz, no relative, I'm sorry to say, wrote a book in which she analyzes this. And in the middle of this story called The Golden Ass is a little chapter, I think it's chapter 11, called The Story of Eros and Psyche. And it's a wonderful book. The Golden Ass is a very bawdy story, very rich, bawdy story. And there's a lot of interesting material in it about this subject. A friend of mine says about fate that fate is what happens to you when you're making other plans. So what am I saying? I'm saying that there are a lot of very difficult, you could say, choices that one has to make. There's a lot of tears and suffering that goes into all these things that I'm talking about. There's a lot of pain, disappointment, disillusionment, frustration, loss of direction, a feeling of hopelessness. Usually, individuation begins when you are at the depths of despair, the very bottom not just in despair, but below despair, when you wake up in the night and think, what the hell am I living for? That's the beginning of that discrimination that has to be made as you begin to kind of sort yourself out, and you sort out what's most meaningful to you, what really matters. Illness is a very quick way to figure out what's really important, whether it's your illness or illness in your family. I'm sure many of you have had that experience where suddenly what's really important becomes so self-evident that you wonder why it took you so long to know what was really important. Those are the things the individuation process makes very clear to you. I don't want to sound like a Hindu mystic, but sometimes I think that so much of life is an illusion. that there's an illusional quality to a lot of things that we think are so important. And we have to, in order to come and make our mistakes and find ourselves. I think what I'm trying to say, I don't want to, I don't want to be confusing, but I think what I'm trying to say is consciousness of your own suffering, consciousness of your own fate, of your own life, of what has happened to you, why, what you can make out of it. I mean, if you're a victim of the Holocaust and that you, your fate, your family history, your family of origin, had you born in Germany in that moment in time, and that the world burst forth in this monstrous psychic infection at that moment in time, we're not talking about did you make the right decision or did you make the wrong decision. We're talking about how the hell you integrate that into your life and go on with your life and find out the meaning of your life. Believe it or not, one of my dearest friends said to me, who was escaped from the Holocaust in 1933, she got out because of a dream. That is listening, see? That is listening. In spite of the fact that her friends said, why are you leaving? Things aren't that bad. She had a dream, and she got out of Germany like that. She didn't even wait for money, for anything. She just blew right out. She said that without what happened to her, she would have been an ordinary housewife. But what happened to her so changed her life. That would be the outer fatality. So changed her life that she became an incredibly developed human being. Now, it wasn't the Holocaust that made her a developed human being. It's what she did with what that did to her. Do you understand? So there's a lot of work that we're talking about. This is not a simple thing. This is from volume 13. Only have a couple of more pages. We'll be out of here soon. Jung says, an ancient adept has said, if the wrong man uses the right means work in the wrong way. In reality, he says, everything depends on the man and little or nothing on the method. The method is merely the path, the direction taken by a man. The way he acts is the true expression of his nature. If it ceases to be this, the method is nothing more than an affectation, something artificially pieced on, rootless and sapless, serving only the illegitimate goal of self-deception. And it becomes a means of fooling oneself and evading what may be perhaps the implacable law of one's own being. These are very strong words that he uses, the implacable law of one's own being. That's from The Secret of the Golden Flower. He wrote the introduction to it. Don't you agree with that, that it really is the person? Then he says, I've got a big red kind of mark next to this, so it must be something I adore. He says, we're all so greatly tempted to turn everything into a purpose and a method that I deliberately express myself in very abstract terms in order to avoid prejudicing the reader, also in order to chew your food for you. He didn't say that. I have been deeply impressed by the fact that the new thing prepared by fate seldom or never comes up to conscious expectations. And still more remarkable, though the new thing goes against deeply rooted instincts as we have known them, it is a strangely appropriate expression of the total personality, an expression which one could not imagine in a more complete form. Now, one of the things that Jung talks about in terms of individuation has to do with our culture. What kind of a culture do we live in the West, in the Western world, not just in the Pacific Northwest? What kind of a culture do we live in?
Extroverted.
Extroverted. What else? Materialistic, sure.
Death denying.
Mm-hmm.
Hillman says manic.
Fearful. Thought, thinking. Mm-hmm. Well, so a lot of what our particular struggle has to do with the culture in which we were born into. Now, Jung says that a Chinese can always fall back on the authority of his whole civilization. If he starts on the long way, I think the long way is called Wu Wei, he is doing what is recognized as being the best thing he could possibly do. Pardon. But the Westerner who wishes to set out on this way, if he's really serious about it, has all authority against him. Intellectual, moral, religious, aesthetic, or intellectual flirtations with life and fate come to an abrupt halt here. The steps to higher consciousness leave us without a rear guard and without shelter. I'm going to say that again. The steps to higher consciousness leave us without a rear guard and without shelter. The individual must devote himself to the way with all his energy, for it is only by means of his integrity that he can go further, and his integrity alone can guarantee that his way will not turn out to be an absurd misadventure. Now, whoever said that I was making this sound easy, think about if you make a direction in your life and make a choice that makes you look like a fool, you better be damn sure of the integrity of that choice, so that even if you look like a fool to everyone else, you will not be a fool to yourself. Jung says, whether his fate comes to him from within or from without, the experiences and happenings on the way remain the same. Therefore, he says, I need say nothing about the manifold outer and inner events, the endless variety of which I could never exhaust. On the other hand, he says, there is much to be said about the psychic states that accompany the process of development. These comments also come from The Secret of the Golden Flower. What do you think about the Chinese who, as he puts it, who starts out on the long way and is supported by his culture, that the difficult road, the untraveled road, the narrow road, is the way, the long way, as opposed to, you know, what? You're 21 and you haven't made your first million? I saw a young man, 22 years old. He owned a house. He owned a house. He owned a boat. He owned two cars. He was getting a divorce. He was getting a divorce. He had a child, 21 years old, and he sat there in my office. Talk about identification with the father archetype. This man was about 102. And he said to me, he said, you know, he said, these toys are not much fun anymore. I could have cried. What way did he take? What kind of patina came on him? It's going to be very, very touching when he has to come face to face with what is going to give his life meaning. Now, his parents may have loved it. That's, you know, or his uncle may have thought, terrific. I'd like to close with something that I think is really kind of a side of Jung that I would like to leave you with. And this is about yourselves as well as about your psychologists. He says, anyone who wants to know the human psyche would be better advised to bid farewell to his study
and wander with human heart through the world. There, in the horrors of prisons, lunatic asylums, in drab suburban pubs, hospitals, brothels, gambling halls, in the salons of the elegant, the stock exchange, socialist meetings, churches, revivalist gatherings, through love and hate, through the experience of passion in every form in his own body, he would reap richer stores of knowledge than textbooks a foot thick could give him. And he will know how to doctor the sick with real knowledge of the human soul. Now we're all going to go to a friend's house and have a beer and talk about all this. Okay. If any of you have any burning questions, speak.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.